Okay.
Yeah, it's going. Come on.
It's going.
Jesus Christ, I give you the cold open. And I trust you, Jimmy, and you've snatched it away from me.
I'm seeing how awkward we can make this.
Right, okay. So,
this is the Right Dishonourable podcast with me, Jimmy.
Me, Jazza, and we have a guest today. Say hello, Ellen.
Hello, Ellen.
You're hilarious. So we are the Right Dishonourable, where we talk about politics, social issues, and generally run our mouths on stuff as if you're just down the pub with your mates, so that, like, no opinions are taboo here. We can all agree to disagree at the end of it and then go away and continue the conversation on Twitter, which, by the way, you can follow us on at Right Dishonour if you like. Ellen, tell us about you and what you do and where people can find you.
Hi, I'm Ellen. I'm also known as Ickle Nelly Rose on YouTube. I'm also on Twitter. I've got Facebook. I just talk about my opinions. I talk about gaming and politics and stuff like we will be talking about today in the podcast. Yeah.
So I'll link to Ellen in the show notes. But
that's a lot more professional than what we do.
Yeah, I know.
I feel bad now.
So Ellen's going to be showing us up with her knowledge on things, but today we need to go through what we're actually going to talk about. So first of all, we're going to touch on what I am going to continue to refer to as Thigh Gap Gate.
But what everyone else is referring to as the Beachbody Ready Fiesta.
So Protein World, a sports supplement company, put up a quite controversial advert on the Tube of a very thin lady saying, "Are you beach body ready?" And the Advertising Standards Authority has said that that is not offensive. And so we're going to chat about that. After that, we're going to talk about Heathrow. Is that right, Jimmy?
That is right, yeah. Today, the three-year-old commission headed by Sir Howard Davis. Is that right?
Yes.
This week it delivered its report and it recommended that we expand Heathrow to include a third runway. Understandably, people are quite upset about this, particularly Boris Johnson and Zach Goldsmith, who, you know, coincidentally have constituencies in that, in and around that area.
And funnily enough, Ellen, who lives under the flight path of Heathrow. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be very handy getting a local person's perspective on that. And then finally, we're recording this. This won't go up until like the 5th or the 6th of July, but we're recording this on the 4th of July, which is National America Hates the Monarchy Day. I made that joke, and basically we're going to be discussing what's the point of America, what are you even doing these days, guys? Maybe touching on the presidential race, if anybody has any interest in that, but we'll see what happens. We'll just run our mouths as three ignorant Brits talking about the USA. So if you like this podcast, then subscribe to it, but we're going to get into it now. First of all, we're going to be talking about the fact that the Advertising Standards Authority has waded in and given its verdict on the now infamous Are You Beachbody Ready adverts that were all over London in the run-up to summer for the supplement company Protein World. Jimmy, would you like to describe the photo that kind of made everybody feel a little bit uneasy?
So,
as the token straight male, would you like to make this description?
I didn't realise I was here for token reasons, but so it's a large yellow banner and it has a picture of a, should we say, scantily clad lady wearing.
She's wearing a bikini.
A bikini, like. Yeah, she's wearing a bikini, and as Jazza has repeatedly pointed out, she has quite a large thigh gap.
Massive.
But other than that, she's quite thin, has quite large boobs, and the caption alongside her is, "Are you beach body ready?"
And I feel like a lot of the controversy of this was, you saw a lot of people posting the kind of images on Instagram and Twitter where it was like, actually I'm always beach body ready, how dare you, yeah I've got a tubby waist. Going from one token of the straight white male to another token of the only woman on the panel today, Ellen, what was your initial reaction to seeing those photos? Well, the actual adverts. Because I understand you found them before they were cool.
Yeah, the hipster when it comes to this. I was at a train station and there, I saw a massive one, like one of the huge posters on the wall. And I just looked at it and I thought, fuck's sake. So, and that's literally, I just took a picture and tweeted that. And everyone was like, oh, not another one of these. And because it's something, I don't think it was just that advert that's the problem. It's the problem of, you know, the whole context of advertising and how women are more often shown in certain ways than guys are. And I think it's important to know that, you know, guys do have expectations on them as well, which I'm assuming we'll be bringing up later. But having studied advertising at uni as part of my degree, which
and is therefore an expert.
Yeah, well, kind of say I've had experts relay me information. Like, it's the number of times that women are shown in a particular way, of a certain body type, often sexualized. It's overwhelming, like, the number of times. So I think it wasn't just so much this was a bad advert, it was the straw that broke the camel's back. And because it was bright yellow, everyone can see it, everyone's like, right, this is the one that we're going to have a go at.
Isn't this really good advertising, though? So it stood out from all of the other adverts that are objectifying women, which we see on the daily. We'll see, like, dozens of those every single day. Is this not actually just... And it provoked a response as well. So is it not actually a mark of good advertising that they managed to...
I've heard it was really good for sales. I've heard it has boosted their sales somewhat. Obviously, there was a huge amount of news coverage, which in effect is free advertising.
Exactly. So although they were controversial, do you think that actually we should be patting Protein World's advertisers on the back and saying, oh, look, you provoked a response and got a hashtag and everything?
I don't think that was... It's, for me, though, it's whether it was their intention. I don't think we should congratulate them. I don't think we should congratulate them if it was a massive accident. Like, if anything, like... I would congratulate them on using something that was so... eye-catching, i.e. yellow, but that's the only thing that I would congratulate them on, because everything else is like, it's totally unoriginal. It's just, you know, oh, you beach body red, like, that's a phrase that constantly comes out every year. It's
so
cliche.
the thing that I found and the reason that I think of this as like thigh gap gate is because I feel like it came to prominence and the social media response to it was really strong when the whole kind of idea of a thigh gap being something sexy and being something aspirational kind of started seeping into the mainstream. And they very clearly kind of, they've positioned the lady so that she looks like she has a particularly large gap between her thighs. If you're coming into this podcast not knowing what a thigh gap is, I'd probably tell you not to Google it, but just use your imagination. But do you think do you think there's anything commendable, Jimmy, to what they have kind of shown? So you can juxtapose this with, for example, the adverts of This Girl Can, where it shows women of all shapes and sizes and all abilities doing any kind of sport and saying, I jiggle, therefore I am. Yeah, I'm hot and sweaty and doing salsa. Compared to, I need to look absolutely fabulous. How would you juxtapose those?
I'm not really sure what you're trying to get at, really, because one of them is trying to be a socially responsible, charitable thing, you know, backed by the National Lottery and what have you. Mm-hmm. And the other is trying to sell a product. Mm-hmm. And
make you feel insecure.
Yeah, well, effectively, it has done that job, hasn't it? I mean, no one really disagrees that
has it made people feel insecure, yo, or has it kind of created this groundswell that we saw and that was reported on places like BuzzFeed of women being like, hold on, like, I can wear a bikini if I want and I can not have a perfect body?
Well, I think it has created that, but not directly. It's through people's responses to it. Like, it's using that advert was using the oldest trick in the book when it comes to advertising, which, if you look back, like, at advertising through history, it's making you feel insecure about something and then going, hey, look, this will get rid of that insecurity. And it's just, you know, because it's one of those things where everyone's aware that, you know, there's certain expectations for societal ideals in terms of bodies. So it wasn't so much a kind of, oh, we're pointing out this insecurity. It was a kind of, oh, you all know that you should look like this. But I've kind of lost my track there.
What happened in terms of, like, their response? They were like, well, if you're feeling offended by this, and if you feel like this is an unrealistic body ideal, then buy more of our products, because then you'll be able to look like this woman.
It is, I mean, it is kind of an unrealistic body ideal. She doesn't, you know, having seen other pictures of her, she doesn't have a normal body type. I don't mean that in an offensive way, but it's an outlier.
All of you can tweet at Jimmy and tell him how offensive he's being to everybody who has like foot long thigh gaps.
But I actually don't have a huge problem with the advert, because I think people can see it and they can make their own judgment. And I think most people will probably see it. Most women will probably see it and go, "Well, I don't really care." I mean, that was kind of your response, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So there's been a somewhat patronising response to this from certain quarters, in that it's almost as though treating women as though they can't deal with this sort of thing. But I sort of accept your point, I guess, which this is part of a wider problem, as it were.
Yeah.
Do you think that the response could be seen as patronising to women who see that and maybe aren't depressed but like get riled up? Do you think that there was just the assumption that, oh, people are going to be really offended by this? Was the response too PC?
No, I think the response was, we are sick of seeing this. And it was people snapping more than kind of, oh, we should be coddling women. It was women turning around and going, could you stop shoving this in our faces? Because it was that bright yellow. It was that ideal, this weird kind of stark contrast between this very grey-scaled looking model. I don't know why they did the colouring on that, because it makes her look really ill. and like against the yellow background, and it's so like, are you beach body ready in big capitals? And
how much of the ad would they have to change before you stopped having a problem with it?
How would you advertise protein products to women specifically?
It's like talking about kind of something about more getting into shape, or find your shape, or something like that. Something that's not so much, oh my God, buy this and get skinny.
There you go, Protein World. There's some free advice for you for your next campaign. I also wanted to talk, because it's not just unrealistic images of women in the run-up to specifically summer, because there is this overarching idea of, guys, you're going to be like scantily clad on the beach. You've got to look good, otherwise you're not going to pull. And it's not just women who are getting these ideals shoved down their throats. And I think actually there's as many, if not more, of those kind of unrealistic body ideals in adverts for like fitness products on like the tube and stuff. So this is obviously very salient for me, because I'm a guy who goes to the gym, and I am shown that, oh, unless you have like a 5 foot chest span and like have triceps the size of bowling balls, then you're not going to amount to anything.
You feel you're being intimidated by the
I'm being adverts. Incredibly intimidated by the protein adverts. But these kind of images are ubiquitous at the moment, of unrealistic body ideals across all genders.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people agree that it's not very nice, but it is companies trying to sell their products. What are the consequences of this, if any? Are there any negative consequences to this, other than, I feel a bit shit about myself?
I wouldn't say it's as so much as a cause, which I think is what you're implying, is a symptom of people do feel that they have to conform to certain ideals or whatever. People feel that there are good body shapes to have and bad ones, and that to a certain extent is true, I guess, just in terms of what people find attractive. But at the same time, there's obviously tremendously damaging psychological effects if people feel that I have a bad body shape and I cannot change that. And there's an unwillingness to maybe accept certain things, which certainly adverts like this wouldn't help.
Do you have, how do you feel when you go across the tube and you see all of these specifically fitness products that show these kinds of images of men and women with what could be argued are as like unrealistic body ideals?
I don't really care, but I think that's maybe my personality more than representative of the way people feel. Because I actually do go to the gym, not that you'd be able to tell, but...
You're looking ever so svelte, Jimmy, don't you worry.
Most of my peers, I guess, go to the gym or like worry to some extent about their fitness or about their physique. But I think men care a lot less. Like I think when I chat to women about like how they feel about eating and the way women talk about food compared to the way men talk about food, the contrast is just amazing, really, because we just shovel crap into our mouths all day, whereas women are like, they think about carbs and stuff. I've never thought about carbs. Carbs are just...
I don't know. I feel like that is changing, and it may be because of the kind of background that I'm from in terms of, like, being a gay man and being from Essex as well, where, like, body ideals of men has been quite... warped in the mainstream in that particular county. And yeah,
I just want to say, how do we feel about a public body deciding whether or not something's offensive, like making a ruling on that?
I think that they can make mistakes. There was one that they did pull that was a Rihanna fragrance advert that I remember seeing.
Was it Rihanna naked? Because she was naked quite a lot of the time.
The thing is, it said she was naked, but when you actually looked at the picture, she wasn't, and it was obvious wasn't. And I thought, okay, so they don't like that one. But there was one of an can't remember the brand, but it was a woman. It was a Burberry one, I think, and it was that blonde lady in a coat. It was a tan coat that came down and opened so you could pretty much see half of her boobs, just not the nipples. And it was just like, how come that was like on a massive billboard on my journey home? And this bit where Rihanna's she's just in a doorway, got her legs, her feet rested up against the door frame, and she's looking at the camera in a kind of come hither way. And that's
Do you think that these kind of things should be deemed as offensive? Or do you think everyone should just get the hell over it and get on with their lives?
I think, you know, we've got to make some provisions because there are things, you know, you don't want people of certain ages to see, and there are some things that you shouldn't be promoting, like extremely skinny body types, because that can affect people's health. You know, it's not trying to be the health and safety brigade, but, you know, you've got to be careful with things. You can't just like shove images in people's faces all the time.
I am going to wrap it up there because we've come to time on this topic. But if you do want to continue the conversation with us and tell me that I'm a terrible person for calling this Thigh Gap Gate, then you can find us on Twitter at Right Dishonour, or you can go to our website and comment on us there, the Right Dishonourable. Oh no, just rightdishonourable.com. I will get the website correct at some point.
Maybe you'll start writing for it as well.
I've written one thing.
So this week, after 3 years, the Davis Commission finally delivered its report on where Britain should expand its airport capacity, and they came down firmly on the side of Heathrow, which was the result that almost nobody wanted, except for Heathrow themselves. What they've recommended is that they build a third runway in the northwest of the airport, which means that the other principal contender, Gatwick, is no longer in the running, but has been sort of set back quite a way. And the other option, the Thames Estuary, was dismissed a couple of years ago. And the fourth and final option, which almost nobody talks about, is extending the second runway at Heathrow, which also is not really on the cards anymore. We all around this table have opinions about this based on where around London we live. Some of us live in flight paths, so. Maybe it's best we start with you, Ellen. What do you feel about this as someone who lives quite close to Heathrow?
Yeah, I for all my life I've lived under the flight path where I used to live in Fulham. It was a little bit quieter, but where I've moved to now, it's a little bit more obvious when a plane flies over. In fact, if you go and watch some of my YouTube videos, you will actually hear planes, even with the windows shut. But it's one of these things where you get used to the noise. So I don't know how much I would notice an extra plane every once in a while going over. But my concern is for the people who actually live near Heathrow who are going to
be displaced.
Yeah, are going to have their houses knocked down. Like that's their homes, you know. And I, for one, also, you know, I think Gatwick is a slightly better option just because there is so much traffic at Heathrow. Just in all forms of transport around there, it's ridiculous trying to fit more people into that one very small space.
But it is our hub airport, though.
It is.
Like,
it
when
is
people
hub.
Fly into London, they fly into Heathrow. It's generally like the... in terms of what people expect, they expect to go into Heathrow.
Yeah.
Do you think it would just be difficult to kind of shift that international standing to another to one of our secondary airports in London, which would be Gatwick?
I'm just very aware of the knock-on effect, and that these reports is all about all money, business, which I understand is important for the economy, but there's not so much thought going for the people who are going to be most affected by it, who actually live there.
So we were talking about the possibility of an estuary airport and how that was written off a couple of years ago. Yeah. And Ellen was saying that you actually quite liked the idea of that if it weren't being backed by Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
Originally. I mean, that's fine. Feel free to shade on Boris Johnson as much as you like.
It's worth pointing out that Boris Johnson also doesn't want the extension at Heathrow.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
I'm sorry, is absolute rubbish. It's only because now he is a constituency MP for Uxbridge, which is affected quite.
To be fair to him, he's always been in favour of the Thames estuary. So there is actually, there is a consistency there.
I was under the impression that he's kind of swayed from, oh yeah, I never said something as stupid as that. But the reason that I really like the Thames Estuary Airport is because it's similar to what was done in Hong Kong. Mm. So Hong Kong had an incredibly impractical airport that was in the middle of the city. It was renowned as being incredibly unsafe because you had jumbo jets going in at like 45 degree angles to take off and to land. And so they just up sticks and moved everything to a completely new island, an artificial island on just off of the Hong Kongese island itself.
I don't know about that airport, but it's worth pointing out Heathrow is the second biggest airport in the world in terms of international traffic. So the scale of...
Hong Kong is pretty high up there.
The scale of what you're talking about is... Hong Kong's up there now, but Hong Kong wasn't necessarily up there before they made the move.
And so they're up there now after having made an artificial island airport, which is what the Thames Estuary would be. And it's so obviously that's an incredibly unattractive option because it's hugely costly, because it takes a really long time. But what are we going to do once we're at capacity with three runways at Heathrow? Build a fourth? Like, what's our option going to be then? If you build something completely from scratch, make it shiny and new, surely for the long term of like flights in and out of the capital, that would be the most sensible option.
Well, if you're talking very long term, the principal objections against Heathrow, the fact that people are going to be displaced, that's bad for them, but it's not actually, compared to the disruption of moving an entire massive airport across the capital, it's much smaller. The two other complaints are about air pollution, which is already above legal limits, and also the noise levels. The thing about the noise levels is long term, planes are going to get quieter. Even if you look back the last 30, 40 years, planes have got significantly quieter, which means that although the number of flights from Heathrow has gone up hugely, the number of people affected by noise has gone down hugely. And that will probably continue. If you're talking the next 40 years, then yeah, certainly that will change. The pollution thing, I think, is more of a problem, and also the political gridlock is a huge problem as well, because Boris is opposed to it, Zach Goldsmith, who's potential next Tory mayoral candidate, is opposed to it, and David Cameron...
Dav Cam,
5 years ago...
It is going to work.
Okay. Dav Cam, 5 years ago, said that no ifs, no buts, no third runway at Heathrow. So if he now backs this, he's going to look stupid than he looks now.
I mean, I wouldn't put it past him, to be completely honest.
I'm suddenly wanting the third round. In hopes of him ruining his political career.
Just a load of schadenfreude directive at Mr. Cameron right now. Will you talk about air pollution and the fact that there is a huge amount of opposition in environmental circles to any airport expansion? Would that have ever been an option? And should we have perhaps invested it more in high-speed rail and bicycles?
How are you going to bike your way to America? Like, put paddles on it.
So I'm being slightly facetious, but there is the argument to reduce the attractiveness and the affordability of air travel because it is the most carbon inefficient way of somebody to travel. And so, for example, somebody flying to Paris or to Brussels, it like incentivizing people to actually take the train or to... I'm not sure what other options there are. Zeppelin.
Drive, take the ferry, cycle if you're a nutter.
Was reduce, was just not having any airport expansion and possibly ceding the role as Europe's hub airport to something like Paris, Charles de Gaulle, or to Amsterdam. Was that ever an option?
It depends how much you like money, I suppose. So it does come back to Ellen's argument of, you know, do you value environmental concerns? Do you think that, I mean, a lot of people have made the argument, is it really necessary to have all this business travel? Because the Heathrow argument is primarily about business travel. It's not actually about commercial travel, people jetting away for their holidays. So could you actually have more video conferencing and all that junk? As someone who's used video conferencing and conferencing calls, I'd probably say no, because I don't, it doesn't work all that well. There's a reason that, you know, companies, you can't call companies like capitalist bastards and then simultaneously say, well, they're just shedding money on this pointless travel all the time. You know, you have to pick one of the two. And I'm sure that a lot of this business travel, it does actually yield some benefit, even if it only gives you a slight edge in terms of winning business contracts and whatnot.
Ellen, what would your solution to this be? In an ideal world with Ickle Nelly Rose as Prime Minister and Lord Dictator, what would you be doing to, as like going forward with the possible expansion of Heathrow, would you just tell people to teleport?
Teleport. Well, I went to university up in Scotland and I would always travel by train because I just, you know, weight restrictions on baggage when you're trying to take textbooks back and forth was one thing, but I just felt like, you know, I'm doing my bit for the environment as well by going by train instead of getting on a flight for an hour. And then literally when you're flying to Scotland, when you fly from London to Edinburgh, you reach the height that you can, you know, actually fly at for about 20 minutes before you start descending again. So like there's a lot of things like with short haul flights and things like that, I think we need to be able to find like invest a bit more in,
but
other
what
transport.
Would Dictator Ikenya Ikhuneli Rose do?
Dictator? I don't know whether I could still, I'm a bit too
She's
nice.
She's a very consensual dictator.
Yeah.
Our benevolent dictator. It will be like North Korea. Would you choose for it to be, for us to have a completely new one in the estuary? Because that's certainly my, I think that that is the most sensible option long term. Obviously,
Prime
politically.
Minister, that's what would happen.
I mean, I'd be the president of the new republic, let's be fair. but that's what I think is the most sensible option when you take away the politics of it all and the fact that you'd have to sell something really hard to the electorate. Mm-hmm. What would you be doing if there were no restrictions?
I think the estuary idea is a really good one, especially in my eyes, a lot of the business in London is over in East London. So for they'll probably really like it because it make things easier on them. We've also got, you know, the city airport and stuff as well. That would probably kind of be part of that then. But it's really difficult because you've got all these different people wanting different things. But like in an ideal world, we wouldn't have to be building a massive extra runway or having to invest in all this. But yeah, ultimately, I just think, I don't know what I think.
I don't think anything. There's also kind of the fact that Crossrail is already like nearly finished. Crossrail, the largest infrastructure project in Europe, that is taking, that is going to be a train line from Heathrow to out in Essex somewhere. And for you to start decommissioning Heathrow now that there is a completely new infrastructure link that has been built there specifically for easy access to the hub airport, do you not think that it was inevitable that Heathrow was always going to get this because of the amount of money that has been invested in the Crossrail project?
Some people have wondered whether this isn't a bit of a stitch-up, really. I guess it depends how much faith you have in
the government stitching us up. I'd never have thunk it.
Well, it was a stitch-up in the sense that they deliberately commissioned the report at the time they did so that they wouldn't have to make a decision before the general election, which would have been hugely problematic for them. But, I mean, ultimately, whether you support the Thames idea is it, I mean, we haven't even spoken about Gatwick, but if you support the Thames idea, it depends how valid you think Howard Davis's judgments are on, you know, the economic viability of any of those schemes. Because it would cost, if you think about the cost at Heathrow, the astonishing rise compared to the
Can I come completely clean? So I'm like a schoolboy in that I love big infrastructure projects, and I get really excited about stuff like Crossrail
and
HS2, and the idea of building a completely new airport from scratch on an island that doesn't exist yet. And that's basically me indulging the inner 5-year-old that used to play with Thomas the Tank Engine train sets. But beyond that, it looks like we are probably going to get Heathrow as like the expanded airport.
I actually think Gatwick is quite likely because of the political difficulties, particularly the air pollution thing as well, will be another great reason to say no, we can't do anything more at Heathrow. The fuss that they're going to kick up, whereas the number of people who will be affected by noise is, I think I want to say like 200,000 in Heathrow, and it's like 25,000 in Gatwick. The difference is that large at least. So yeah, I mean, I think Gatwick is more likely than Heathrow, purely for political reasons.
I just feel really sorry for Stansted and Luton now. The forgotten second-tier airports of London. Stansted is great. There are so many EasyJet flights from there. If you guys would like to wade in on this conversation, what do you think is the most viable option? Is it Heathrow? Is it Gatwick? Is it the Thames Estuary, which is what Dictator Jazza would do? Let us know on Twitter at Right Dishonor. Obviously, I'm plugging Twitter a lot this episode for whatever reason. Maybe. Ellen, if they want to disagree with you, where can they find you as well?
I'm at Icklenelly Rose.
And we'll put that in the show notes too. And now we're going to go on to the 4th of July. Oh, America. What's the American national anthem? Okay, yeah, well done, Jimmy. Jesus Christ. Oh, what have I become? Today, the day of recording is the 4th of July, which is obviously, it is Independence Day, isn't it? It is Independence Day.
Yeah.
Didn't you pitch this idea?
Pitch this idea, and I'm very happy with this idea. I think it's a great idea. Because I feel like Americans in general are fascinated by how the rest of the world views them. And I think that is brought quite specifically from the fact that there isn't an awful lot of interaction with other cultures from the majority of Americans.
Americans don't have passports and don't give a shit about the rest of the
world. No, but as a result of that, I feel like they are fascinated by, like, oh my God, why do you think of Americans? Yeah. Like, that's my, like, kind of
most of
interaction.
Americans you meet have gone across the Atlantic and landed in London. And,
yes.
You know,
yeah.
It may be there's a sampling error there.
So we thought it'd be a very good idea for us to just kind of see what three ignorant Brits in a hot living room in Hackney would, like, if we chatted shit about America, what would come up with it? So in terms of, like, international relations and how America is viewed in the world, what are your opinions of the nation that, like, is now being run by Barack Obama and will soon have a new president? Are they still kind of like the international police and the international bully that was kind of the archetype in the 80s and the 90s?
I quite like America, and I feel that, particularly like on the left of British politics, that makes me a weirdo, really, because there's a general feeling of hostility towards America because of it. If its embrace of capitalism and its lack of a coherent welfare state and all of the other problems that are associated with that. But particularly given the events of the last year involving Russia and also involving the Middle East, I think the much derided role of America as the world's policeman is actually, the value of that is becoming far more apparent than it ever was. And, you know, tied in with the problems that Europe is having with the euro, with Greece, with the migration crisis, I'd actually like America to be having a bigger role in world politics rather than a smaller one.
Wow, okay. Do you agree with Jimmy, Ellen? Do you think that America should be kind of rising up and being the leader of the free world again?
Well, I'm not sure about being, like, the ultimate leader of everything, but I do think that it helps for them to be more involved with everything and, you know, help out other nations where we can, like, any, you know, nation that has the ability to go in and, you know, not take over like sometimes has happened. But like go in and offer like help and aid and, you know, where we can. And I think America has a big role to play in that.
So Barack Obama kind of made it very clear during his second term specifically that he wanted to shift his international policy from a transatlantic agreement to relations across in the East, in the Asia-Pacific region. And you can actually see that now because the negotiations for TTIP, which is the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership between the USA and the EU, has kind of taken a backseat in the US for the TPP, which is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade deal between the USA and China. Do you think that we are kind of... the special relationship between the UK and the US, which I think is more salient on this side of the Atlantic than the other. Do you think that that special relationship is kind of gone to the dogs and he'd rather have a chat with Angela Merkel or Xi Jinping rather than DavCamp?
Well, who would want to have a chat with DavCamp? That must be like a painful conversation to have to sit through. So,
I wonder where Ellen falls on the political spectrum.
No, I think it's just, you know, they want to pursue new possibilities. I mean, there's only so many times we can continue to talk about the same things. And yeah, we're great friends. It's that thing where, you know, you should let your friends hang out with other people as well, not just you. You know,
I love that you're personifying nation states now. There was something quite symbolic. I believe that originally the White House, before Obama came into power, the White House had 3 or 4 busts of Winston Churchill, and now there's only one. Do you think...
outrage.
Well, no, there was genuine outrage, and people like Fox News were actually fighting the Winston Churchill corner.
Why do you need 4, though? I mean,
because he was American-born.
Can you ever have too many busts of Winston Churchill? I have 6 in my own room alone, so...
Well, I think the question to bring up here is, you know, Winston Churchill is obviously a key figure in World War II and in history, but why is it that after World War II, people didn't vote him back in again? And like that's, you know, how, you know, in the UK, we went very socialist, and then suddenly we had the NHS.
I mean, we had Attlee, and then Winston Churchill won another election, and then was out after one term.
Yeah. I think that premiership is widely regarded as pretty impotent as well. Maybe a bad word to...
Yeah, no, quite a terrible word. Back to the USA. What is the relevance of a holiday like Independence Day for people like us? So I remember being a Brit abroad in China and it coming across to American holidays like Thanksgiving and Independence Day. And I would be wished Happy Independence Day by all of my Chinese classmates. And I was like, no, they had independence from me. Like, this isn't necessarily the best day for me. But do you think that we don't have such a holiday in the UK? We don't have such a holiday that kind of celebrates British nationalism. And it's been often said in the past that we miss out on that kind of pride of the British flag. Do you think that the US is a better country for having this holiday?
I think it speaks to the different ways that America as a nation was formed as opposed to Britain as a nation was formed. Yeah. Because there's actually a very pivotal event that you can kind of pin the start of America on, whereas with Britain it was all a bit more inchoate and
cobbled together.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
I think we have plenty of opportunities to wave the flag, but because we have a monarchy, it's all to do with the royal family. So we have, you know, our babies born and weddings, and that's when we all get the flags out.
And ironically, Independence Day is all about them saying goodbye to the monarchy, but the Americans are bloody obsessed.
Oh, yes, they are. It's quite ridiculous. I went to St. Andrew University. For those who don't know, that's where Kate and Wills went, and everyone asks me, oh, you didn't get William, and I'm like, no, I don't care.
So, he is going bald.
Yeah, well, it's more like I would not want to sign up to be constantly followed by the Daily Mail.
I don't know,
you know,
but she does consistently have fantastic hair.
She's got beautiful hair. but when Will first came to St. Andrews, and it was announced that he was going to St. Andrews, applicants from Texas tripled. So that's just one random fact. So I know that there were a lot of American girls being like, I'm going to go to America. Sorry, I'm going to go to St. Andrews and buy a get. Sorry, I can't do it.
So I'm now going to put a veto on all American accents around this table, please. I'm not happy with how this is going. What do we think about the role of... So do you think that David Cameron and Obama get on as like world leaders? And do you think that it matters?
I think David Cameron. I think he allows David Cameron to be in his presence. There wasn't that, you know. There was Tony Blair and Bush, like, as much as it, you know, you could hate them at some points. They had, you felt like they got on, even mm-hmm. though you felt like it was still America, like George Bush patting Tony Blair on the head a bit, like, oh, you Brits, you're so cute, you know. But it was just a bit...
They had a shared mission, though, didn't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, they had a shared mission. They had a goal, a common goal, whereas we don't really have that at the moment with them.
I'd say that's mostly because David Cameron is very weak on foreign policy, that he has no particular vision for the way the world should be and the way and Britain's role within it.
People argue the same about Obama as well, that he's quite weak on foreign policy.
I think that the trouble for from Obama's point of view, which I guess speaks to the whole Asian pivot thing, is that whilst he was trying to pivot towards Asia, the Middle East collapsed.
Yeah, Syria happened.
and you know, the Middle East collapsed, Russia invaded the Ukraine effectively. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in those sort of circumstances, when equally the EU cannot perform because it cannot keep together, you know, what kind of coherent foreign policy can he have, given all those challenges landing in his inbox at the same time?
Yeah. This wouldn't be a Right Dishonourable podcast without us being incredibly speculative, without any basis on actual practical knowledge. But the presidential race for 2016 has well and truly kicked off. I think there's now 14 or 15 candidates for the Republican side, and a fairly substantial, well, no, like a modest a group of candidates for the Democrats. Who's your pick for president in 2016?
Hillary.
Great. How about you, Jimmy? Do you know anybody else apart from Hillary?
I'm, you know, not on a first name basis with any of them, to be honest. But I sort of want, but I want Bush to be Jeb Bush to be Jeb. Picked for
Jeb! Exclamation mark.
Not. I should add, not for president. Like, definitely not for president. But I sort of want to see him win the Republican race just for the poetry of it. You know, the Clintons versus the Bushes round. Or whatever it is.
Yeah, I'd also a bit of schadenfreude to see if Donald Trump got in, just because if he did get in, like, it would be awful. But then America would have a president whose last name is, in a colloquial English, fart. So...
Oh, I never even thought about that. I kind of almost hope that Donald Trump gets it as well, for the same reason that part of me really hoped that Sarah Palin would run in 2012 and win, just to see the world go to shit. It would just be very, very entertaining.
Do we actually know the names of many other candidates?
So there's a guy called Bernie Sanders who is drawing huge crowds on the Democratic side.
He's to the left of Hillary Clinton.
He is like the liberal, basically. So he probably shares a lot of ideology with David Cameron. It's like, because American politics is so much more to the right than ours.
I didn't realize David Cameron had an ideology or any ideas.
Yeah. Well, let's just get back to gay marriage. He pushed that through. He pushed that through.
Bullshit, he did.
But Bernie Sanders is like a really interesting candidate, who is kind of like the Jeremy Corbyn of the Democrat Party, I think. He's kind of pulling his party to the left. And then there's the Jeb Bushes and the Chris Christies. Chris Christie, who in 2012 was incredibly popular, could have had a good chance at actually winning against Obama, to be completely honest. But now is so hated in his home state because of his local politics that he's probably just going to be a flash in the pan and pull out in a few months. So that those are our opinions on your politics, America. If you think that we've gotten anything wrong, do let us know.
If you think we've got anything right, then please let us know.
Yeah, actually, that would be really nice for the affirmation. Just so that we can massage our egos. Ellen, thank you very much for coming on. Where can people find you on the interwebs?
I am on YouTube, Ickle Nelly Rose. I'm on Twitter, the same, and I'm on Facebook and Instagram. Just all those things. Go to my YouTube channel, all the links are there.
YouTube whore. And Jimmy, where can people find you other than The Right Dishonor?
You can find me on Twitter at JDE Nichols, and that's it. No other, none of the other bullshit.
Cool. And you can find me primarily on Twitter at Jazza John. This has been The Right Dishonorable Podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Make sure that you rate 5 stars because it helps a lot. And leave a review if you fancy as well. I've been Jazza.
I've been Jimmy.
I've been Ellen.
And we'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye. If you like this podcast, then subscribe to it. But we're going to get into it now. Jingle.
You should just use that.